And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, signing off for myself and Alter Proof right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna rabbakumullahu alladhi khalaqa as-samawati wal-arda fi sittati ayyam. خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the Islamic Republic will return to its nuclear commitments only if the U.S. lifts all of its sanctions first. Palestinian rights groups welcome the International Criminal Court's ruling on its jurisdiction to probe Israeli war crimes. We'll bring you a report from Gaza. Also ahead, over a dozen people are confirmed dead and many more are missing after a massive Himalayan glacier broke away in northern India. Welcome to the World News. Our top story: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Tehran will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the United States lifts all its sanctions first. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says that is the definitive policy of Iran and will not be dropped.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the country will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the United States lifts all its sanctions first. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, is the name of the nuclear deal Iran clinched in 2015 with world powers, including the US. But America withdrew from the accord under former President Donald Trump and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. Now, the new president, Joe Biden, says the U.S. will return to the deal, but Iran must first return to full compliance. Iran rejects this, arguing that it was the U.S. that exited the accord and breached its commitments. Ayatollah Khamenei says it is the definitive and irreversible policy of Iran that the U.S. should first lift its sanctions. The leader also says that it's Iran that has the right to set conditions on the nuclear deal, as it has fulfilled all its commitments under the agreement. The leader's comments follow calls by some Western countries to renegotiate the Iran deal and expand it beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. We have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region. And this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now.
Iran has time and again stressed that the JCPOA is non-negotiable. The country rolled back some of its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after the US pullout. Iran did so after the European countries in the JCPOA, namely France, Britain and Germany, failed to make up for the US withdrawal. Tehran has repeatedly said its rolling back measures are fully reversible once other parties fulfill their commitments. Iran says the ball is now in US court. It says President Biden should now decide on whether to continue the policies of his predecessor or choose a new path. Those policies by Trump under his so-called maximum pressure campaign have already been described as a failure even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Palestinian human rights organizations have welcomed the International Criminal Court's ruling that its jurisdiction extends to Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli regime since 1967. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinian human rights organizations have hailed the decision by the International Criminal Court, ICC, after affirming that the court has full territorial jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories, including the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, together with its partners, stressed that immediate action must be taken by ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda to investigate Israeli atrocities and ensure justice and accountability for Palestinian victims. For decades, the Israeli regime has been causing pain and suffering for Palestinians. It has waged three wars on the Gaza Strip and has kept the tiny enclave under crippling blockade. Tel Aviv has also increased illegal settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem al-Quds.
This is a very important decision, and Palestinians have been waiting for it, because it might finally bring them justice after many years of Israeli occupation and crimes. The crimes have been systematic and taking place on a daily basis.
Families of war victims in Gaza say the ICC decision is a step in the right direction towards achieving justice. They demanded that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes.
Israel has killed 8 members of my family because it felt that it would get away with it. Today, we want justice for our loved ones.
The ICC must prosecute Israel for its war crimes during the last three wars on Gaza because of its forces killed and injured thousands of innocent and unarmed Palestinians, including my son.
For decades, the Israeli regime has demonstrated zero accountability to crimes perpetrated by its soldiers. Rights groups demand accountability mechanisms to ensure that Israeli perpetrators are brought to justice in accordance with international law. Experts say that Tel Aviv's crimes against Palestinians will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from the United States.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
A recent report shows hundreds of Palestinians have been detained during Israeli raids across the West Bank last month. We discussed that matter with our guests in our news review program.
In this edition of the News Review, several Palestinian rights organizations have reported the arrests of more than 450 people during different Israeli raids across the occupied West Bank in January. In a joint report, the organizations, including the Prisoners Affairs Commission and the Palestinian Prisoners Society, said 93 minors and 8 women were among those detained last month. That reportedly brings the number of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails to some 4,500.
Some of them are put under the regime's so-called administrative detention for up to 6 months without trial, which is, of course, extended to an unlimited period. Palestinian rights groups have decried new Israeli detention amid a coronavirus crisis. The report emphasizes that over 350 Palestinian inmates have been tested positive with COVID-19 in different Israeli jails due to the regime's deliberate medical negligence. To discuss that further, we're joined by Paul LaRubi from the Free Palestine Movement, joining us live from Berkeley, and Firas Al-Najim, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights in Ottawa. Now, let's begin with Paul LaRubi. Now, Paul, it's quite interesting, the stats that we have received: 93 minors, 8 women, only in January, are among these prisoners.
That's correct. The Israeli plans with regard to treatment of the Palestinians, this includes, for example, assassinating them in the Great March in Gaza and other aggressive actions by Israel. They have always moved to a new normal. They'll do appalling things, and then they will stay at that level of atrocities until the noise quiets down, and then they'll raise the level of atrocities even more. It seems that that's perhaps what they're doing now. Their treatment of children has been very great during the last year, and rightfully so. If it's gotten quieter, if people are paying less attention, it's because it's happening on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. So they're hoping for monotony in their atrocities so that they can then raise them to a higher level later on. That's part of what's going on.
Thank you very much. That was Mr. Paul LaRubi. Now let's bring in our guest from Ottawa, Firas Al-Najim. Can you tell us more about this administrative detention? What exactly does that constitute?
This is a continuous violations and criminal actions of a criminal regime. And it's what they're trying to do is over and over again to just have the whole world immune to their crimes and to stay quiet and silent about it. And just, you know, they want us to adjust to this as this is a very normal thing. And the Palestinians are not really human beings. And, you know, that the Palestinians are the ones that are breaking all the laws, and they are trying to implement the laws, and they are trying to bring security to this, illegitimate regime. And unfortunately, the United Nations is always silent. You know, once in a blue moon, we get a condemnation, a statement here and there, but then there's no action taken with it. There's no sanctions. For instance, a coalition of armies to get involved, like how they got involved in certain other countries, such as Libya and so on. And that's exactly what that should happen, pretty much. You know, like when you see a regime like this continuously killing the citizens of that country, till this day, you know, they have them barricaded, blockaded. They have all these checkpoints. Children are waiting in checkpoints. Women, they can't even get to hospitals. They die, And now we have this corona crisis and virus spreading. And the Zionist regime does not care about international law. Does not care about human rights, does not care about any of these things. And like I said, the most important thing is that the sanctions are imposed on them and there's real punishment to the Zionist regime. And I think the best way to do that today is, all the human rights organizations, all the activists will keep pressuring their governments, the officials, to address this issue and to do something about it. We cannot just stand silently anymore and just watch this continuous, aggressions, because injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. And this biased system is when they see another country having some political turmoil and a few violations here and there, they will highlight it and they will fight day and night and to try to penalize them. But then they leave this regime to do all things with a green light. And that's why we need to do the BDS movement, for instance, boycotting Israeli products. We have to do our own simple sanctions against them, and they hate it. You can see that they're going out day and night, the Zionist lobbies in different countries such as Canada, and trying to criminalize BDS, a very basic, simple movement of just trying to, you know, say that we don't want to buy the products from this regime. We want to penalize them somehow as just normal citizens, as normal human rights activists and people that care about humanity. And they don't even accept this. This shows this intolerance that they have, shows, because what it does, it highlights the crimes. It highlights what the system is about, and they don't want that. They want to be highlighted as if they are the country that is prosperous, and they're the country that is democratic, and that they're advanced and all this kind of things. And they want people to look beyond that. So it's pretty much interests and benefits and financial gains and advancements over human rights, over international law.
Thank you very much.
The time has to come.
Thank you very much, Firas Al-Najim, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, live from Ottawa, and also Mr. Paul Arudi from the Free Palestine Movement, joining us live from Berkeley. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for sharing your opinions with us, and thanks to all of our following this edition of the News Review.
On to another one of our top headline stories. A massive Himalayan glacier burst leaves a trail of deaths and destruction in northern India after crashing into a dam and causing huge flooding. The government has confirmed 14 deaths, while scores remain missing after the tragedy in the state of Uttarakhand on Sunday. At least 4 hydropower plants in the area were damaged and 2 bridges washed away after floodwaters forced their way through the Dauli Ganga River Valley. Most of the missing are believed to be workers from those plants. The army has been deployed to help with rescue efforts. Authorities have also alerted people against rumors of another flood after some reports suggested a rise in water level. People in Myanmar again take to the streets to denounce a military coup that led to the arrest of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Over 1,000 people marched in the streets of Yangon demanding the immediate release of Suu Kyi. They called on the military to hand power back to the elected politicians of the country. This is the 3rd consecutive day of rallies in Yangon. Similar protests were held in the capital, Naypyidaw, and several other cities. Suu Kyi and key government officials were arrested and detained by the military in a pre-dawn raid last week. Amnesty International has described as arbitrary the detentions carried out during Paris protests against the controversial security bill on December the 12th of last year. A French branch of the Global Rights Watchdog said out of 142 people who were arrested, including 124 taken into custody, nearly 80% faced no charges in the end. The watchdog said it has, quote, legitimate concerns over the possibility that they were arbitrary arrests and the other violations of human rights during the demonstrations. The controversial legislation, which has since been scrapped, would have restricted publication with so-called malicious intent of photos of on-duty police officers. The move was condemned as a curb on press freedom, triggering widespread protests in France in December of last year. While confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the virus-stricken United States have reached a dramatic milestone of 27 million, as deaths have exceeded 463,000, sadly. Despite vaccination programs being underway, the U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic, both in terms of cases and deaths. Out of nearly 60 million vaccines distributed, some 40 million have so far been administered. On Friday, the U.S. set a new record in daily fatalities as well, with more than 5,000 deaths. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the Americas region, the coronavirus cases in Brazil have surpassed 9.5 million. Deaths from the disease in the South American nation have surpassed 231,000, the second highest in the world. I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, D.C. earlier. Colin Campbell told us the U.S. is currently facing logistical issues in the distribution and administration of COVID-19 vaccines. Take a listen, please.
Yeah, right now the U.S. is dealing with the vaccination campaign. And that's really one of the biggest concerns, is that there are all of these people who need the vaccine, especially those that are coming from our elderly populations that are not getting the vaccine as quickly as they were expecting to. So right now, what the White House is facing is a logistical issue. Although they have been able to administer the vaccine in various states, they are still trying to figure out the best way to get it up to the speed and the number of people that need to be vaccinated by the end of the year. If we remember, the Biden administration said that he wanted millions to be processed by the end of the year. But remember, a couple of the vaccines have to be done in two doses. So you have getting the dose to the people in the first round, but then also getting them to come back a couple weeks later. That's also been an issue. Now, we do have a third vaccine that looks like it may get approved for emergency use, and that's from Johnson & Johnson. That's a one-time only vaccination. Now, it doesn't have as high as an efficacy rate as Moderna and the other one, the Pfizer vaccine. However, they are saying that it still helps to protect people from contracting the virus if the virus is around them. So there's been a rush to get these vaccines out to the millions of Americans that are still adversely affected by the spread of the coronavirus.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. so to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
U.S. leading baby food manufacturers are selling, knowingly or without warning, unsafe products contaminated with dangerous levels of toxic heavy metals that can cause serious and often irreversible damage to infant brain development, according to a new congressional investigation that is generating renewed calls for greater regulation of the industry. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Congressional Report Reveals American Manufacturers Knowingly Sold Toxin-Tainted Baby Food. Stay tuned for the details, please. U.S. leading baby food manufacturers are selling, knowingly and without warning, unsafe products contaminated with dangerous levels of toxic heavy metals that can cause serious and often irreversible damage to infant brain development, according to a new congressional investigation that is generating renewed calls for greater regulation of the industry. Dangerous levels of toxic metals like arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury exist in baby foods at levels that exceed what experts and governing bodies say are permissible. Representative Raja Krish Moroti, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy, which conducted the investigation, told CNN recently, "We know that in a lot of cases, we should not have anything more than single-digit parts per billion of any of these metals in any of our foods," she added. Yet evidence provided by manufacturers shows that some baby foods contain hundreds of parts per billion. The report is based on an analysis of data provided by some of the nation's largest manufacturers of baby food, both organic and conventional. Out of seven companies asked to participate, only four cooperated with the investigation. The subcommittee's investigation revealed that manufacturers knowingly sell tainted baby food to unsuspecting parents, in spite of internal company test results showing high levels of toxic heavy metals and without any warning labels whatsoever, the statement said. Scott Farber, Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group, said that this is yet another example of the Food and Drug Administration's failure to protect our families from the chemicals and contaminants in food. This is what happens, Farber added, when you let the food and chemical companies, not the FDA, decide whether our food is safe to eat. Arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury are heavy metals that the FDA and the World Health Organization have declared a human health hazard, particularly for babies and toddlers, who are most vulnerable to their neurotoxic effects, which include brain damage, behavioral impairments, and even death. No level of exposure to these metals has been shown to be safe in vulnerable infants. Linda McCauley, Dean of the Nell Hodgson Woodruff School of Nursing at Emory University and an expert in environmental health effects, told the New York Times recently, "Even low levels of exposure to toxic heavy metals endanger infant neurological development and long-term brain function. Despite the risks they pose, the FDA does not set limits on heavy metals, specifically for baby foods, except for arsenic in dry cereal," the Times reported. CNN noted that even that level, 100 parts per billion, is considered much too high for baby safety, critics say, especially since the FDA has already set a much lower standard of 10 parts per billion of inorganic arsenic for bottled water. This is an endemic problem that's been swept under the rug and never addressed, Tracy Woodruff, director of the Program on Reproductive Health and Environmental at the University of California, San Francisco, told the Times. "It speaks to the many areas that we need government to be active in," she said, adding, "Consumers can figure it out on their own." The subcommittee distilled its findings, which apply to organic as well as conventional products, into four key points. Top baby foods are tainted with dangerous levels of inorganic arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury. Industry self-regulation fails to protect consumers as manufacturers set their own dangerously high internal standards for toxic heavy metal levels. Manufacturers routinely ignore internal standards and continue to sell products with higher heavy metal levels. Manufacturers' prevalent practice of only testing their ingredients in concealing higher levels of toxic metal in finished baby foods. The four companies that complied with the subcommittee's request for internal documents and test results were Nurture Incorporation, which sells Happy Family Organics, including baby food products under the brand name Happy Baby. Bijnaut Nutrition Company, Hain Celestial Group Incorporation, Hain, which sells baby food products under the brand name Earth's Best Organic, and Gerber. The following three companies were condemned by the subcommittee for refusing to cooperate with the subcommittee's investigation, which might be obscuring the presence of even higher levels of toxic heavy metals in their baby food products than their competitors' products. Campbell Soup Company, which sells baby food products under the brand name Plum Organics. Walmart Incorporation, which sells baby food products through its private brand Parent Choice, and Sprout Foods Incorporation. As the Times reported, representatives of Walmart and Campbell Soup disputed the characterization, saying the companies had responded to requests for information, although they acknowledged they did not provide testing data. Sprout did not respond to a request for comment. According to the report, representatives from Hain, which makes Earth's Best Organic, gave a secret presentation to the FDA on August 1, 2019. Though it was ignored by the Trump administration, the company revealed that corporate policies to test only ingredients, not final products, underrepresent the levels of toxic heavy metals in baby foods. In 100% of the Hain baby food tested, inorganic arsenic levels were higher in the finished baby food than the company estimated they would be based on the individual ingredients testing. Inorganic arsenic was between 28% and 93% higher in the finished products, the subcommittee wrote. This presentation made clear that ingredient testing is inadequate and that only final product testing can measure the true danger posed by the baby foods, researchers added. Charlotte Barodi, National Director of Healthy Babies Bright Futures, said the report's compelling new evidence lays bare the FDA's clear failure to protect babies from the toxic heavy metals in their food. While the FDA studies the problem and companies set lax internal standards, Browdy added, millions of babies are exposed to these contaminants every day. It is time to step up and finally take your action.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with Nico Vitafle on this week's show. We'll be looking at the economic war between China and the U.S., particularly focusing on the tussle for the top of the world's largest economy ladder, something that appears to be about to change. Well, the impact of the COVID-19 virus has, of course, played its part in the world's economy, yet it seems that the recovery time from the depression caused is something that could be a factor in just how individual economies pick up again, with China seeming to lead the way as it bounces back from the financial impact seen in the year 2020. But it's not just the COVID-19 pandemic that has seen economies rise and fall. As from back in 2010, the Chinese economy began to exponentially gain on the U.S. economy, chart from the CEBR World Economic League table, which also shows that by the year 2028, the Chinese economy will catch up with and surpass that of the U.S. Naturally, China excels when it comes to foreign exports and is hence a major factor in why it is able to recover so well. Yet, as things settle down in China, it is the domestic market that also sees China take an advantage over the U.S., as we can see in this chart over here. Retail sales in China are rising faster than those of the U.S., which is still seeing lockdowns and closures prevent its economy recovering as fast as that of China. Now, in order to take a deeper look into just what is happening on the Sino-American economic front, let's get straight into our first report, which addresses the issue on a deeper level.
The race is on for the world's largest economy as global nations emerge slowly but surely from the devastating effect of the COVID-19 pandemic that rocked economies and cost lives around the world. The two current largest global economies, the United States of America and China, remain locked in horns as per prior to the arrival of the virus. But now it seems, as the world sets out its agenda to recover, is just how fast each nation will be back on its feet, and is something that will no doubt determine just how quickly China catch up with and eventually surpass the US as the world's largest economy.
Before the pandemic, there was clear evidence that China was going to surpass the US in terms of its size of GDP. And on some measures, our GDP measured as purchasing power parity, China had already done that in 2019. So the pandemic itself wasn't the reason for this. This was already happening.
Whereas China has demonstrated that it's been able to successfully return into the black following the pandemic, with factories and shops opening up again and lockdown measures all but eradicated, the opposite is true in the United States, which is still seeing its economy struggle to return to pre-pandemic levels, and is something that will no doubt hinder the rate in which they finally do recover. Furthermore, the US under the leadership of ex-President Donald Trump made it a daily routine to put America first, making sure that its internal economy was the priority, almost ignoring the notion of multilateral trade, something that China has done with great interest, with examples being the Global Belt and Road Initiative and the signing of the regional RCEP agreement, which saw China boost its regional economic sway.
Multilateral trade systems is the answer to promoting world GDP, and also forestalling any kind of military or economic frictions. So, yes, I think trade is the solution to many of the world's problems. The more interdependent we become, the less likely we want to start fighting each other.
With predictions suggesting that the US and China will meet economic parity in 2028, the world, and in particular the US, will be keeping a keen eye on other emerging economic powers, such as India and Russia, as they edge their way up the table, potentially one day pushing the US further down the economic leaderboard.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. Mahan, welcome.
Pleasure.
And we have our special guest, Ming Du. He's a professor of Chinese law and trade and current director of the Center for Chinese Law and Policy at Durham University. Professor, many thanks for being with us today. First up, the U.S. and China, they're jostling for the top spot as the world's largest economy. Now, are we set to see a change in the status quo, do you think? Or is the global financial complex on a radically different route inspired by recent global events?
Thank you for having me today, Kavi.
My points to your question are basically two points. First, I think China's economic growth is unstoppable. Barring any major disruptions in international relations, I think China is on its path to the number one economy in the world. But that being said, we should not underestimate the U.S. resilience, given the historical examples, and U.S. has gone through some even worse major disruption, but somehow it recovered. So I think China is going to be number one, but it may take a little bit of time for China to achieve that spot. Thank you.
Well, Mahan, one of the main reasons that China seems to be catching up with Americans in terms of at least their GDP growth rate, where it counts is the fact that they seem to have emerged from the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people are talking about that much more quicker and more efficiently than the U.S. has. And, of course, this is being reflected in the economy. Do you think that the U.S. mismanagement is, in essence, the main reason for the Chinese exponential growth rates?
I think the key word here is resilience. The Chinese economy, and more broadly the Chinese state and its society, just far more robust and resilient than their Western counterparts. I mean, let's face it, the West just fell apart in the face of this pandemic. Look at the UK, for instance. It has the highest death rate per capita in the world. The US is in disarray in terms of COVID-19, but China, where the virus supposedly originated from, has dealt incredibly well. It suppressed it very early on because it's a much more cohesive country. State and society work very well together.
This particular entry over here talks about how the first country hit by COVID-19, and it says it controlled the disease, but it did not need to repeat economically paralyzing lockdowns as European countries have done. So that, I think that's another important point here in terms of the lockdown, repeated lockdowns.
That speaks to preparedness, both on the part of the state and also on the part of society to accept very harsh measures very early on to get on top of a problem. The problem in the West, specifically Western Europe and North America, is that the society and the state were not in sync, you know.
Very well. Well, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate the comments made there by Mahana and, of course, the professor. Now, in terms of what we're going to see next in this next report that has been prepared, we're going to be hearing from both of them again later, but we're going to look at just how military spending may be having a negative effect on the American economy, something that China seems to have avoided to their advantage.
It can be argued that one of the main reasons that China is catching up with the US is based on two very important factors. The first is the most obvious, namely the way in which the country makes its money, which for China predominantly comes in the form of large manufacturing output, one that essentially sees China being labelled as the factory of the world. But the second factor, and one that may be overlooked by many, is how each nation spends its money. And this is where the real difference comes into play when it comes to comparing the US and China. Although the US enjoys a huge income from its well-established military-industrial complex, the US also spends more than any other nation on military hardware, in fact seeing the US spend over $732 billion in 2020, three times that of China on $261 billion. China, although the world's second largest military spending nation, has used much of its income in investment, in particular when it comes to the technology industry, proving that its research and development in the area has boosted its GDP by leaps and bounds, and is something that the US have attempted hard to curb in the implementation of sanctions against various Chinese tech companies, none more so famous than leading Chinese telecommunications company, Huawei. Furthermore, the One Belt, One Road initiative has seen China invest into infrastructure, logistics, and technology across the world, in fact touching over 140 countries, hence seeing China divert its funding away from the military complex and into investment and long-term strategies, something that has potentially boosted the Chinese economy like none other.
I think this, the Belt and Road initiative is more an extension of its economic power. In much the same way as the private sector expanded in the British Empire in the 19th century, this expansion of economic power is projected through the Belt and Road Initiative. What's needed in China to sustain its position as the largest economy and the most powerful economy is productivity in China. Trade will go some way towards that, as the Belt and Road Initiative is meant to support, but that in itself is not sufficient.
With the US clearly aware of the fact that China is fast catching up with it, various stalling methods have been placed against China, including the sanctions that we've just mentioned. But more worryingly, seeing the US stoke the flames of tension in places like Hong Kong and Taiwan, something that could cause a Cold War to rapidly warm up.
It could really depend very much on the miscalculation on either side, because for China, domestic consumption of its policy is extremely important, and therefore, if it looks as if they're being threatened by an outside force, their real worry for China is not so much the outside force, but what happens inside. And therefore, that would force them into acting militarily.
Back with me in the studio is Maan Abedin and Professor Ming Du from Durham University. Okay, we go to the professor, see what he has to say. Yeah. With this next question, Professor, the U.S. spending trillions of dollars in its military whilst China has concentrated on technological advances, boosting its economy in the process. Do you think the tech industry is China's catalyst to undermining the U.S.?
It's true that China is spending millions and billions of dollars on its technology industry. Whether it will overtake the U.S. or undermine the U.S. in this respect, I believe is unclear. Well, the background of China's focus on technology is, of course, technology is China's Achilles heel. For example, China is still unable to produce its own semiconductor chips. The U.S. sanction against Huawei by prohibiting supply of chips has put a lot of pressure on China's national GNP. So, well, it's indeed a wake-up call for China's government to concentrate its resources on developing some core and key technology. And, well, will China succeed? I believe so. Given time, yes. But it takes time for China to sort out its technology problems and overtake the U.S. in that regard.
Well, Maan, we have to talk about, obviously, how the U.S. has taken great steps to curb the progress that's being made by the Chinese. And one of those was the way that it dealt with Huawei in terms of the way it restricted it, and there were many different facets of restrictions that happened. Looking at what's said over here, they barred from doing business with Huawei due to national security concerns was the big reason that the U.S. brought, and also supplying equipment for network infrastructure to supply chains, et cetera. Do you think the U.S. made a concerted attempt without holding back to stop China advance technologically?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, under the previous administration, they did everything they could. And Huawei, I think, is actually the best example. They did two things in relation to Huawei. They actually put pressure on Canada to detain one of the executives of Huawei, and she's still under house detention as far as I know. And more importantly, they applied so much pressure on the UK to cease all cooperation with Huawei, because Huawei was tasked with developing the UK's 5G network. And initially, the UK agreed to the deal, and then they reneged on it, saying that it can only have a peripheral role to play. And then the Brits even went further as a result of American pressure and said, we will terminate all cooperation with Huawei before the end of the decade.
Okay, thanks again to Maan on that. We do appreciate it, and of course, the professor. We're gonna, we have plenty more coming up, but right now we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kava Tahwe. Time now to take a look into the U.S.-China economic sphere in more detail in our in-depth section. Now, as discussed throughout the show already, the COVID-19 pandemic has taken its toll on both the Chinese and the U.S. economies. But as we emerge from the pandemic, a report by the Center for Economics and Business Research suggests the U.S. economy is expected to grow by around 1.9% annually between the years 2022 and 2024, slowing to 1.6% after that, whereas the Chinese economy is expected to grow by 5.7% annually until 2025, before settling in at 4.5% thereon. Moving on to the next one, as things stand, the U.S. and China are the top two largest economies in the world, with the U.S. enjoying a nominal GDP of $21.44 trillion compared to China's $14.4 trillion. However, when we look at the GDP per capita, due to China's large population, it would only require a GDP per capita half the size of that of the U.S. to see China's overall economy become twice the size of that of the U.S. Okay, on to the next one. It seems that it is not just China that is threatening the U.S. position as the world's largest economy, according to Standard Chartered Bank. Once the U.S. falls behind China, it will likely never be able to replace it again. It may even fall behind the rising economy of India. By the year 2030, 35% of the global GDP will be created in Asia, with six of the world's top 10 economies being found in that region. And now on to the next one. It seems the key to success for China is what is called the Belt and Road Initiative, which, unlike the U.S., has seen China avoid spending money on its military, instead investing in the global economy, with figures of between $50 to $100 billion a year being distributed into thousands of projects across Asia, Africa, Europe, and South America, yielding high returns in the process. Time now to take a look at our final report in this episode, as we look into how Sino-U.S. relations may look with a new U.S. president at the helm, one that appears to have already started reversing multiple decisions made by his predecessor, Donald Trump.
Many people, when asked whether Joe Biden will do a better job than Donald Trump when it comes to Sino-American relations, will likely answer words to the effect of, well, he couldn't do any worse. Yet is this really the case? The 46th President of the United States has already shown so much promise in reversing many of the policies set by his predecessor, as demonstrated by the pile of executive orders he signed on his first day in office. However, so far, none of the actions taken by Biden in his first days and weeks in office has pointed to any sign of change in U.S. relations with China. With Biden very much aware that the COVID-19 pandemic has slapped the U.S. economy harder than ever, as well as the notion that the nation he now presides over is more divided than ever, is the gentleman persona that Biden wishes to portray a false flag character? And does the mom and pop look hide the true Biden, who may well turn out to be nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing?
A wolf in sheep's clothing sounds like a good way of describing it. I don't think policy towards China is going to change radically. I think what's going to be different is the way it's going to be projected on the world press. And that's quite important for China, because face-saving policy is extremely important in their thinking. So it'll be a return to the sort of Roosevelt-type policy, that is Theodore Roosevelt policy, that is to speak softly and carry a large stick. So the kind of policy that will be going will be one that will be less confrontational, but it certainly will be challenging China.
But for Joe Biden, the U.S.-China relationship is not something that can just be brushed under the carpet, with the world clearly having to take multiple issues more seriously than ever, be it the environment, security, trade, and of course global health. The U.S. have indicated that both patience and consultation with allies is key as to how the relationship may play out over the next 4 years.
We're starting from an approach of patience as it relates to our relationship with China. So that means we're going to have consultations with our allies, we're going to have consultations with Democrats and Republicans, and we're going to allow the interagency process to work its way through to review and assess how we should move forward with our relationship.
What now remains to be seen is just how patient the U.S. can be. There's no doubt that China is fast on the way to replacing the U.S. as the world's largest economy, and should other Asian nations follow suit, it could be more of a problem than expected for the U.S. However, if there's one thing that Joe Biden will want to leave as an early legacy of his presidency, it's the notion of undoing the mistakes of Trump, be this at home in reuniting his polarized country, or across the international arena where Trump haphazardly lost the United States so many admirers and friends.
Back for the final time with us on this episode of Economic Divide is Mahan Abedin and also Professor Ming Du. Okay, let's go straight to the professor. Professor, my last question to you, looking to the future of the Sino-U.S. relations. Joe Biden at this point has taken the helm there in the U.S., reversed many of Donald Trump's policies. Do you think that he will work towards reversing the U.S.-China decoupling policy that was set by Donald Trump, hence easing the ongoing trade war in the process?
Well, no. I think the Biden, Biden had a lot of differences with Donald Trump, but towards China policy, I think Biden has a very similar view against China. Well, with that being said, Biden is going to continue the competitive pressure on China, but Biden might adopt a different strategy. For example, Trump may prefer the unilateral stance against China, but Biden will make alliances with other countries, with the Europeans, with Japan, with other of its allies against China to organize a united front against China. I think that competition, the rivalry between China and the United States will continue with Biden administration, the period.
Okay, Professor Ming Du from the University of Durham, many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Kavi. Thank you.
Sure. Well, Mahan, it can't be argued that Donald Trump created such a toxic environment when it came to China and also the U.S. It's going to be hard for Biden to make some changes. I mean, we're yet to see really any motions forward by Biden in terms of China. What are we going to see when it comes to Biden making a difference in this whole scenario? Basically, when you take a look at the policy that is put forward, we know the pivot is there, and it's going to remain there in that sphere. But the trade deal is one of the things that needs to be looked at, and this is among the issues that, at this point, the U.S. is reviewing. What direction is it going to take?
Well, you know, Sinophobia is deeply entrenched in the psyche of the U.S. government machinery. So even if Biden wanted to reverse some of Trump's policies in relation to China, I think he's going to find that extremely difficult to pull off. And look, I mean, China, I believe, is going to surprise everybody. I mean, hitherto, China is simply focused on developing its economy, having this global economic reach,